Because biologists haven't made the cell themselves, and then another biologist is looking at the thing they've made. Whereas for mm-hmm. engineers, all radios have been made by a human.
Welcome to Further Research Needed, where science and philosophy live happily ever after. This is the podcast with straightforward questions and not so straightforward answers. I am Hannes Feirer, and I'm joined by my two friends and scientists,
Jan-Philipp Reising
and Christopher Wood.
Today, in our first Journal Club episode, we're asking the question, can a biologist fix a radio? We're going to try something new today, which is having this episode as in the format of a Journal Club. Well, actually, first, I think, as always, we open our beers. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Shall we maybe talk about what a Journal Club is?
Awesome. Tell us.
So, I mean, there are different forms of a journal club, but in the basic form, it's a group of people who come together and talk about some piece of research that has been published, like a journal article, for example. And in most cases, there's a topic. So, for example, you would have a neuroscience journal club, and then you just discuss recent papers or interesting methods so that everybody keeps up to date with the research in that specific field.
It's nice because it helps if someone you know and can synthesize the ideas in a paper and just tell you what the interesting bits are. I really enjoy journal clubs.
I think today, I mean, we have the issue that we have way too much literature to stay on top of all of it. So if you can kind of carry the weight together and divide the field a bit and just present what we read to other people. And that's kind of standard procedure in most labs, I guess. Definitely in your in mine as well.
So I think for our podcast, the idea would be that the topic would be just a meta look at science. So nothing super specific or with a lot of details, but articles and scientific things looking at
science. That's at least what's happening today. I can't speak for the future. So the paper I brought today is called Can a Biologist Fix a Radio? Or What I Learned While Studying Apoptosis. It's by Yuri Lazebnik. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was a professor in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. And I think now he's a consultant, according to his ResearchGate. And basically in this... So it's not a research paper to start with. It's... I guess you can call it a discussion piece or an opinion or a letter or something like that. And by the way, it appeared in a Cancer Cell in 2002, so it's kind of old. And I think that's also part why we discuss it. It's kind of as a recap if something changed over the last years. And basically questions the approach of biology to a problem and demonstrates this, in his case, flawed approach by applying it to a broken radio. So hence the question, can a biologist fix a radio with the biological methods? And when I tell you about the paper, I want you to keep two questions in mind. One is, do you agree with his assessment of the biological method and the flaws in it? And the second question, did it change over the last 18 years? We do have a bit of an outlook in the paper, so maybe this actually came true or not. He starts off with his experience in the young field of apoptosis. That's where he was an assistant professor in 2002, and he just started this lab. He was super anxious about this gigantic field because there were roughly 10,000 publications a year on apoptosis, and he couldn't keep up, and he was kind of afraid by the time he would just start with research, it was all figured out. Or it would have been figured out by then. While in reality, no one really understood what was going on, we just collected, or biologists at the time just collected a lot of fragments and couldn't really put them together. And in the end, he decided to get counseling or advice from a senior professor in his field who kind of put it into the bigger perspective. Apparently, it's something that happened a lot in new fields in biology. Well, he says in biology, maybe also in other disciplines, that... where he compares the young field of apoptosis to the Klondike gold rush, where like someone finds a nugget of gold, which is a very unexpected result. It opens up this new field, this all these low-hanging fruits and so many things to study with the tools that we have already, which led to at least tens of thousands of papers that have been published later on. While, after all, nothing really was... I don't want to say nothing was discovered, but they didn't really understand a lot. Their models collapsed quickly, and the search for a miracle drug didn't really lead anywhere. At least that's how it was assessed here. And so Yuri tried to figure out why this, or how it came to this paradoxon, even though we studied a lot, we didn't really understand anything. So he decided to do what his math teacher taught him, which is test an approach by applying it to a problem with a known solution. To take it away, in his opinion, the major problem is the absence of a common and a quantitative language in biology. But let me take you through some of the details, because it's a really, really fun read. So in the end, he applies this approach of biology to the problem of a broken radio. So he pretends that a bunch of biologists, or let's say scientists, find a radio and no one has an idea how it works, or how a radio functions at all, and what it's supposed to do, and why it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. So they start to take it apart. They try to sort its components by color. Someone comes about and figures out that, like, if you remove this long, extendable thing on top of it, then it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't do what it's supposed to do. At least it doesn't do what all the other radios do anymore. So they figure out that this thing, which they might call most important component, and we might call it antenna, is crucial for the function of the radio. So maybe if you do something to it, it doesn't work anymore. Or then someone comes about and discovers switches, which they might deem the most important components after all. Another group might come and might just crush the radio into bits and pieces, trying to figure out which pieces are... trying to figure out how these pieces interact with one another by cutting out individual ones. Then someone comes and notices that there's a small cylindrical object. This is usually red in all working radios, but if it's black and smells weirdly, then the radio is broken. But if you then replace it with a red one, it does work again. So I guess that's an analogy to some transistor which burned through. So is that a transistor? Can they do that? I don't know.
I mean, we're all biologists and we don't know how to fix a radio. This is an amazing analogy.
Yeah, it's perfect. So it's kind of fun how he writes that, because it seems kind of ridiculous. The thing he gets to later is that even though a completely functioning radio can stop working by detuning it, so there's a lot of tunable components which we as biologists don't really approach that way, but we just see... And that's, I think, his conclusion. We see blobs and arrows, and these are not quantitative, but merely qualitative. So according to his assessment here is that what biologists like to do is they have a blob, like a protein or some regulator, and then they have arrows going in all other directions to all other components of the system that they have shown to interact with. And this language, these schemes are not quantitative. They don't have numbers associated with them, other than in the language of engineering, where their schemes have numbers, for example, the capacity of a capacitor written on them, which makes it quantitative, and you can calculate and simulate with that. But in biology, we don't have that. We just have arrows without any tuning value on them. And this is, I think, his major critique on the entire field of biology.
So just to cut in there, it's not just biology that suffers from that problem. Chemistry, especially organic chemistry, was built upon a system of drawing molecules using pen and paper. And yes. Like the point in an undergrad's career, probably like second year, is when you realize that the drawings aren't representative of the real systems that you're working with. But no matter what, we always get caught by the fact that we tend to think in those drawings and not think about the real world. We get trapped by the minimizations of the systems we create.
This is interesting to mention that. I think we're going to get to that very quickly, to this, the problem you're describing here. So the next part of the paper, the last part, is he mentions some arguments why the people raise to justify the lack of a quantitative language and why we cannot do that, why we cannot have these formal approaches to biology the same way we have it to engineering. And again, none of us is an engineer, so I hope we're not grossly misrepresenting engineering here. So the first argument is that cells are too complex to be described in such formal approaches like a radio, because a cell is arguably much, much more rich in different components than a cell is. Sorry, than a radio is. Even such a simple one. And he has two counter arguments to that. One is, if the approach of the biologist cannot even apply to a simple complex, simple system like a radio, then it must inevitably fail on a more complex system like a cell. So that's therefore hardly an argument. And the other thing is a bit more complex, more complicated. He says that complexity is inversely related to the degree of understanding of the system. And
that's semantics, we only
yes. So it starts with a semantic, or it's just merely a definition. And he says, but even though some systems might be super complex, the engineer's approach is systematic, slowly building up knowledge rather than collecting random pieces and trying to assemble them in a qualitative manner. And what we can do once we have such an approach is use computer power for complex problems, like we can land a space probe on a flying asteroid, for example, by simulating it first, and then, because we know we're kind of spot on here with our assumptions, we can actually execute it. That's his argument. Does it sound weird to you, Chris?
Yeah, I have a few problems with his approach to this idea. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I think my main one is to kind of twist it on its head and to say what would happen, because biologists haven't made the cell themselves, and then another biologist is looking at the thing they've made. Whereas for mm-hmm. engineers, all radios have been made by a human. So another human looking at them knows that it comes from a set of physical laws or design descriptions that have already been produced and are knowable by ourselves. Whereas I wonder if like alien technology landed on the planet and it was this big amorphous plastic ball that was obviously communicating and self-replicating and doing all these things that none of our technology can do. And we gave it to engineers to figure out how it works. What an engineer's approach to that problem would be. Cause I think that's the same. That's what a biologist is having to do.
Right.
So
I think that's very interesting that you mentioned that. So there are two more arguments raised against, so he raises two more arguments, which he then tries to debunk. But what you're saying is none of them. And I think it's a very valid point.
It's a bit self-centered, but like he is also ignoring the existence of chemistry in the bottom-up approach to studying biology. So
exactly. I think that's the point that you're, or kind of underlying under what you said in the beginning, is that we kind of made the system of a radio, which means we know every component, while we don't know every chemical component of a cell, right?
Not yet, no. Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, we kind of, the chemistry of a cell, we might be closer than understanding the tunable biology of the cell.
There are some approach. I've definitely read some articles where they're trying to make, they say the word artificial life, and that word is now so overused, it's quite annoying to read. But the way they approach it is by stripping E. coli bacteria of every extraneous gene that they can think of until they get to like the minimum viable unit of a self-replicating organism. And then they know exactly which gene does what and how it's replicating. And that work is still ongoing, but that's another mm-hmm. approach to it. It's a bit like you were saying about the take the radio, mush it up, and right. like see
yeah,
what
take
bits.
Out all the unnecessary bits. Okay, the second argument that he picks up here is that people claim a radio and a cell are fundamentally different. That makes sense, right? Like there is an inherent difference between what we see as life, the chemistry that makes self-reproducing organisms, and a radio. Maybe that's what you just touched upon with your argument that we made the radio, but we did not make a cell. Quite the opposite, the cell makes us.
There's a really interesting set of experiments where they use machine learning to create a simple amplifier using transistors. And in this, I will need to have to look up the exact reference, but the evolutionary algorithm that they used to create this amplifier had a set of transistors in a block with one transistor that was not connected to any others. And it was in a design that humans would never create, but there was a transistor that wasn't connected to any of the other transistors. And when mm-hmm. they removed it, the system didn't work, and they still don't quite know how the machine created that setup without, like, just by evolutionary, just by a see what's better design. So one of the big contrasts between a radio, which is designed by a human intelligence, and an evolutionary system is that the radio has to make sense to a human mind, whereas something that's evolved doesn't have to make sense to anything. It just has to work.
But I'm not sure if that's actually true. I think if you design stuff, you will end up with things where you just tinkered for a long time with it, and then you found something that worked, and then you stopped. I don't think that every piece of technology or every engineer that works on a project can tell you exactly why each piece is the way it is. I think you have it to a smaller degree, but also to some degree, this effect that you're doing something until it works. And then, yeah.
That definitely applies in medicine, right? Most drugs that we started using, we had no idea why we did that. Or how they worked.
It's true. I mean, it also applies to big engineering projects. Like if you read about how the new Boeing Dreamliner failed, it's mainly because someone did something and then a lot of other people don't know how that thing worked, but then changed the design on top of that. And then that's where those failings come in. It's because of exactly that.
Let me give you to this argument of fundamentally different. Let me give you his counter argument. He writes, I'm going to quote it for you, Chris, because I think you're going to like this one. He writes, I consider this argument as a sign what I call the urea syndrome because of the shock that the scientific community had 200 years ago after learning that urea can be synthesized by chemists from inorganic materials. And I think his argument is like, we might think they're fundamentally different, but they're likely not, and we just don't fully understand the system yet. And I think we have understood today that life does follow the most fundamental physical principles, just like a radio does. Mm-hmm. Like it doesn't break physics. It might seem unintuitive that we might bring order in our bodies, like we might create negative entropy, but after all, we don't.
But I mean, a counter argument to that would be that you're saying, I mean, I don't think anybody these days is saying that cells do not follow physical laws.
No, but I don't think anyone says that.
So there is a difference in terms of complexity. At a certain complexity level, things change fundamentally. One water atom behaves drastically different from a lot of water molecules. You basically get emergent effects from higher complexity and interactions between the parts. So you could argue that a radio is fundamentally different because it has less parts and thereby less complexity.
Well, it's basically the first argument. We say it's too complex, but not fundamentally different, right?
But then you're arguing about what does fundamentally different mean, right? Because the argument of complexity or emergence is that you cannot explain the emergent phenomenon from the basic properties of the single elements. If you know everything about a water molecule, you cannot predict what the water as a whole does to it. There's like a different level that's not completely apparent from the single unit. Well, I'm not sure, and I would say from a radio that would be... I'm not sure if that's true. But I feel like you could at least make the argument that cells are obviously adhering to the physical properties of the universe, but that there's something fundamentally different about how a cell acts in the world because of its inherent complexity.
I think, yeah, that argument about complexity, he's unfairly loaded his question by choosing a radio. Because let's say a cell is very, very complex and what the things it can do. But then now engineering is starting to touch on objects that are very complex. So like, can a biologist fix a neural network or a supercomputer modeling a neural network? You know, like is that a more valid question to ask in terms
of... Can a biologist fix the Large Hadron Collider?
Yeah, you know, so like it's he picked a radio and we all intuitively think, oh, radios are simple. And to be honest, like I think when I was a kid, I did try and make a crystal radio, and there are like in the tens of components that you need to put together to make it.
Right.
Whereas a cell, the minimum viable product for a cell is... I have no idea. This is going back to our guessing games of how many individually different thing like molecules would you need to make up a cell. But like, it's much higher.
I did have a paper on that, but not today.
It's so much higher than what you need for a radio. So
right.
It's a bit unfair to say that. That's not to say that his point isn't valid. Like, I think it's an interesting...
Yeah. Let me finish the paper before we talk about the validity. The last argument
That's not how journal clubs go. We prejudge everything.
Right, right. No, of course. You usually judge the entire paper just based on figure one, right?
Yeah.
Luckily, there are no figures here. I mean, there's a picture of the radio, but I don't think it's like an actual figure. The last argument would be that we understand too little to apply formal approaches to the system of a cell or apoptosis or something like that. And what he says to that is that, well, starting to do that would actually, or would maybe help us to solve the problems we can't solve right now. And also we might have to do that eventually anyway, because well, the field is developing and science as a tool is also developing. And the early 2000s is when computers came about, right? Like as everyday tools. So his argument was that we should start using those just as we start to use PowerPoint on an everyday basis instead of, well, these slides that I think I've seen like twice in my childhood. You know what I mean, right? These
the plastic
things. Exactly.
Man, I had so many of those.
And there's one sentence I would like to quote fully in the almost in the end of the paper, kind of as an outlook. I just skimmed over your response to the last argument, actually. But that's okay. I assume you had nothing to say anyway. His sentence, quote, "Available computer power and advances in analysis of complex systems raise hope that this time the system approach will change from an esoteric tool that is considered useless by many expert biologists to a basic and indispensable approach of biology." And I think that's important because it very much relates to the future, which is seen from the paper today.
Can I cut in there? Sorry. He used the word systems approach.
Yes.
What does that mean?
So what we understand as the systems approach is what in the individual disciplines we call omics. Proteomics, genomics, metabolomics, transcriptomics. All of these look at a system as a whole, not at individual components like P53, and just looking what the protein does. It would be a very individual and reductionist approach, while looking at all of the proteome at once would be a systems approach.
I'm not sure if I would agree with that. I feel like for a systems biology approach, it's not just enough to do the omics, but then you have like the way you analyze that data is really important whether or not you're doing a systems approach or not. But I feel like
this might be true.
This is one of the criticisms I have basically why I think this paper is really interesting, but it's also a criticism of his
right
of this idea.
Why do you think it's interesting?
So what he's like, how I understand his experiment is he's saying, oh, we're just, you know, like taking the radio apart, looking at each component, and then we're saying, oh, this one is important, this one is not important, and keep on going. Like, this is not a really good way to figure out how stuff works if you're just looking at single components. And I feel like in many cases nowadays, our omics methods are getting so powerful, but we're still doing the same thing.
But don't you think this approach of like taking out one bit, changing it, knocking it out is exactly what biologists did for centuries, especially with systems like Drosophila, where you blast it with UV light, check which gene got destroyed and see what the phenotype looks like?
No. I agree that they are doing this, but I feel like you're always getting a very incomplete picture. So right. Taking all of these omics data, for example, looking at all RNA transcripts, right? What people are doing with this data is going, oh, I'm comparing my knockout model and my wild type, and I'm running my omics, and then I find hundreds of genes that are different. And instead right. of going, trying to model the whole system as a true systems approach to figure out how all of these interact, you're still going back to that old thinking. You're going, oh, this is the component that's really important, or this is the component that's changed, instead of having a more holistic approach, looking at the whole thing, how is the interaction?
Right. In the end, you have this one knob that you touch upon. Let's go back to like P53 and see if we knock out the P53 gene, how does the landscape of RNA transcripts change if I change this one P53 gene, right? Which ones go up, which ones go down? Yeah, basically that.
Yeah, that's the approach that a lot of people,
right.
people take. And I feel like you're not making the most out of the data that you have, right? Because the idea is really good. You're looking at all the stuff, right? It's the approach, I'm taking the radio, I'm completely taking it apart. I'm looking at all the different parts I have. I'm cataloging all of them. And then instead of going, okay, how do these work together? You're going back to going, oh, maybe this knob is interesting. And then I'm going to look at this knob specifically instead of
right.
trying to figure out how does it work in interaction with all the other parts?
Like each individual interaction quantitatively between all the, in this case, let's say messenger RNAs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I think that's the way we're moving towards. And I think we're hindered by technology at the point.
Well, we're also hindered by the scientific method, because we're all taught that we minimize to one variable and alter that. Because otherwise, if we altered multiple variables and then studied a system, it's very difficult to unpick which of those altered variables had the effect. So are you saying that for biology, we need to change the approach to a more, maybe, let's say, computationally expensive method, or, well, certainly experimental time expensive method, where we alter five variables 25 different ways, or however you want it, 5 to the 5 different ways, and then map the outcomes of all 5 to the 5 possibilities of that effect to find out the system's approach to those five variables. Because that's the problem, is the scaling of variable is just insane. Like let alone computational power, which has grown enormously. We just don't have, I mean, we have a few robots now that can do some science, but we don't have enough people to do experiments other than by a one variable change.
Right. Basically, what you're saying is what we shouldn't do is this mutagenesis or knockdown experiments, where we change one variable and look at all the others, but instead we should look at homeostasis, look at the system without changing it.
I mean, if we have the tools to look at a system. So this is go back to the radio analogy. If a biologist could watch the flow of electrons in a radio, then they might be able to study how that works, right? That would give you more information. But we just don't have that technology. And mm-hmm. that's biology. The advances in biology march lockstep in our advances in analysis. And so Once like microscopy improves, we get to another discovery. Once NMR improves, once EM improves, we get another increase in understanding.
I have a counterexample that's maybe closer to biology. So I, like a couple of years ago, I listened to this talk and this guy was amazing. So what he did is he basically took samples of seawater and he was looking at all the microbes in the seawater. And he was trying to figure out in different areas of the world, are there different microbes and all of this kind of stuff. And now you can take the standard omics approach and just give you basically a list of all the microbes he found and all the different things. And there was no pattern. And then he had this genius idea that he went and classified each of these microbes into what their function is. So, for example, are they using nitrogen or are they producing oxygen? Or are they producing something else that's crucial for the whole biological system? And what he figured out is that if you classify the microbes and you compare all the different samples he had, the relative proportions of the microbes in each of these broad categories were the same. So he basically showed samples from all over the world and he color-coded their function in the system and they all looked the same. And it was amazing. So there was like this change into what is the system doing over I'm just using omics and looking at all the microbes. And that's what I'm proposing that a lot of scientific fields have to do. You have to change your approach. And it's not like people didn't know about that this specific bacteria was fixing nitrogen, for example. Like they knew about this, but they were not looking, they didn't have this kind of bird's eye view of what was going on.
Do you guys think this changed in the last 18 years? Do you think we have a more, well, obviously we have a lot of omics these days, but do you think we actually changed our approach?
So I feel like we just basically made the approach we had before more powerful, but the tools to implement the information is missing. So I would like to see a lot more simulations and actually producing models, how all of this fits together, instead of just telling me the data that they're getting out of it, right? I feel like I read a lot of paper and they give me a list of 100 genes that are going up, 100 genes that are going down. And then slowly you have these pathway analyses that are cropping up, but it's all like basically our methods are more powerful than our ways to analyze the data. We're still at the same kind of approach as before. We're still looking at transistors and if the cable is red or black instead of trying to model the thing as a whole.
Right. So what some people would say now is that, or at least we've been putting a lot of hopes into machine learning for this to deal with our data, but this doesn't seem super convincing right now. What do you think?
I mean, it starts the question of do we know how the machine learning is working to come up with the conclusions it's coming up, because that seems to be the interesting thing now with these neural networks and stuff like that, is if you don't know how the result was generated, should you trust the answer that it's produced?
I think that's one issue, but it's also, especially with machine learning, the question is, what are you asking the algorithm to do, right? Like the current machine learning stuff is amazing at classification. If you show it pictures, it can classify if it's a human or other stuff. But in science, it's really important what kind of question you're asking, right? And all these advances we made in machine learning are not answering the kind of questions we have.
What do you mean in science? Just biology now, or just in general? Other? I don't feel comfortable speaking for other fields. I know there have been interesting breakthroughs in chemistry, or at least interesting applications.
Yeah, drug discovery and stuff has been good.
Right. There was this interesting machine learning algorithm which had a small, like, could perform reactions and do some crude analysis, like at a benchtop EPR and NMR too, or something like that, and could, based on these results, optimize its own reactions. I don't know if that was just doing what a human would do just faster, or, yeah, this is something I found interesting.
So if I think about my own field in neuroscience, what I'm trying to ask is, how does this work, right? How is this part of the brain doing its job?
In your case, you talk about the breathing rhythm.
For example, yeah.
Control.
But you could also talk about other parts of the brain. It doesn't really matter. The question is always the same. Like, how does it do its job? But what machine learning could help you with is basically saying, oh, you have a lot of data from different neurons, and I'm going to cluster them for you and tell you, oh, you have like 5 different types of neurons. But it can't answer you, how does it work, right? It's just a tool that classifies stuff.
Right. It's just as smart as we are in asking the question.
I would agree with that. Yeah, for sure. But it's not only about smart. It's also the kind of question that machine learning can answer these days and the kind of question we're asking. I think it's a very useful tool, but it's not going to replace scientists as a whole.
Right. I have one. Sorry, Chris, go.
Ultimately, there's an observer bias here in the fact that we demand answers that are understandable by monkey brains designed to pick the ripest fruit from a tree, right? Like, there's no reason why it should be understandable in a linearly narrative way. And I think we're coming close to the limits of our own brain's processing power when it comes to these things. Like, we can't hold in our heads more than 4 variables narratively to say, like, oh, in the cell, gene 1 upregulates, gene 2 downregulates, but upregulates gene 3, and gene 3 comes in and causes the neuron to do this. Like, that's as far as I can design in my head, and we could probably write a reasonable article about that. But if we start to talk about hundreds of genes, all having their own little narrative arc inside the cell, how would we describe that to each other? How could we even begin to interact with that amount of information?
Yeah, I think the ultimate issue is to, or I think the first thing you encounter, even if something, some analysis were to give you the full answer, I think we could still not comprehend it, but would somehow have to force it, have to cut it into the monkey brain you just described.
So that's a Terry Pratchett quote, but yeah.
Still works.
And I think that's where modeling can step in to try and fix this problem, right?
Exactly.
It can simplify stuff enough that honest. Like, for example, if you think about weather forecasting, right? These things, like whether or not it rains here right now is a very, very complex question to ask. But we have models that take in all of these data, and we have identified all these different variables that have to be taken into account. You throw them all into the model, and then that model can make predictions that are highly accurate.
Mm.
Even though I would assume that if you ask a physicist who is working on this, he could never do this in a set, right? But he understands how the model works, and he can give you like a very interesting answer, I would assume, how the model makes its prediction, even though he can't understand each and every single variable and change and how it influences.
Right. You could argue that's something biology doesn't do, is create predictions based on the models. In a larger sense, in a systems approach, not in a individual approach, not like
I did. Just want to, when you both speak about biology, you're very focused on the microbiology area.
That is absolutely true.
Because like
super biased.
It's quite an old study of the Yellowstone, the introduction of wolves to the Yellowstone National Park, but that single event caused a huge knock-on event to this very complex ecosystem. And they describe like the regrowth of trees because all of the deer got eaten and so on and so forth. And that was quite interesting and there's a lot of work modeling ecosystems in a much more like weather kind of pattern modeling sense rather than a like computational chemistry sense. And so that there are other areas of biology that work in a more modeling style way in that sense.
No, that is absolutely true. And both our discussion, but also the paper we're presenting on the radio is definitely focuses on molecular biology.
Mm. Yeah, and I would hope that basically cellular biology or molecular biology is using the lessons that other fields of biology have already learned and using the tools to try to fix their problems. Because I think like cellular biology, that field of science is amazing at getting very, very detailed information about single units inside the cell. Neuroscience is the same. Like, the amount of information you can get from a single cell is absolutely stunning. But that bigger systems approach is missing in a lot of cases, I feel like.
Just to add to the modeling thing, though, the caveat to modeling is that the models we make are only as good as the mathematical tools we have. So I know this is true of economic modeling, and I think biological modeling as well. When maths was, so this is sort of around the time of Adam Smith, like, maths was keen on steady state analyses and these sorts of things. Economic models followed that. So they all believed that the economy had to follow a steady state algorithm. And so they modeled it using those algorithms, which isn't true. Then mathematics came up with chaos theory, and suddenly they started modeling economics due to chaos theory, and suddenly found, like, catastrophic events occurring during an economy. And that's also true in biological systems as well, where they're not, some are steady state, some are chaotic, some are potentially other models that we don't have algorithms for. So we are limited. There needs to be feedback from the results we're getting from studying the systems at homeostasis to give to the mathematical modelers to create new models to then build the systems up again and to study. It is happening. I definitely know in Imperial, there was a big effort to link the mathematicians with the biologists so that they could see systems that maybe they hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm. There's also a really new way of doing this kind of modeling where you basically use machine learning plus standard modeling. So if you think about a physics model, you have some variables and you know, or you assume what they're doing, and then you fit that to data, right? But the problem is that physics, but biology especially, is very, very noisy. So even if you have, let's say, 80% of the variables that are important correct, because of the noise at the missing variables, it's really hard to fit, right? So this new approach basically uses a part physical model and then a machine learning to fit the noise. And it works, it's way faster, and it gives you really interesting results, because then you can probe the machine learning part, trying to figure out what kind of variables are missing. So this is kind of like a mixture of the stuff we talked about before.
Very interesting discussion following that. I think we touched on so many points that I would love to pick up later, especially Chris's question, if the scientific method is limiting in our success to understand biology. And I definitely have more things to say about this one. But I do think we should cut it here. I went through this paper, and I hope I could get the gist across understandably. And we just did discuss a lot following through that. I'd like if you just each could give like a quick statement to the paper, a quick quick review. I'm just going to start because I presented it. I found the paper, I want to say 3 years ago or so, even though it's much, much older than that. And at the time, I liked it super much because criticizing biology is something that I loved growing up in a more chemical environment. But actually, now that I learned again much more about philosophy of science, I think it's to be taken with a grain of salt. And in the end, the outlook we're getting from the paper is something that we kind of see happen right now. So that this individual approach that we used to have in biology is being replaced by a systems approach, more or less, and it's definitely much more assisted by computer analyses. And I think that's something that is good for the field. And I hope the author of the paper would like that development.
For me, coming at this from a different aspect, so I'm a chemist moving into biology only just now. It is scary how complex biology is. Even the things we've developed, like the things that we understand by using this broken approach that this author has tried to call out in this paper, that amount of information is overwhelming. sufficiently complex for me to understand, like just to read up on it and to try and understand it. So I think my outtake from this is that hang on in there, biologists. It might take longer than you expect, but that slowly, incrementally, things are changing and improving. And like you said, Hannes, new computational tools, new modeling methods are improving on it, but actually we are making progress. And yeah, it's just, it'll take longer than our lifetimes to get there.
I think I would like to end on a similar positive note. I feel like this is a cautionary tale, or it's inspiring in the sense that if you do biology research, you get so caught up in the details and you want to know more and more and more, and you kind of zoom in further and further. So every now and then taking a step back and trying to look at it from a bird's eye perspective is really, really useful. And I think it might give us better results in the long term, thinking about like the big picture stuff versus, okay, how can I make this one specific method so much better to look at it in more detail, but basically going the other way. So I feel like it's important for a scientist to keep this kind of stuff in mind. And it's just a fun example to remind you if it actually makes sense the way you're approaching your research question.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed our conversation on Can a Biologist Fix a Radio? I personally wish we had more public conversations on how we do science and where we might be going about it the wrong way. If you want to send comments or feedback, get in touch on Twitter at Further Research Needed, or via email under contact@frn-podcast.com. That's contact@frn-podcast.com. This is also our website where you can find other podcast hosts and link to our Patreon and potentially some announcements. frn-podcast.com. If you want to support the show, consider becoming a patron. We have exciting and very personal rewards waiting for you. Music credits go to Jay Patterson.